Carmichael versus the people. Justice Ide is not participating in this case. We are ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Karen Taylor, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Mr. Richard Carmichael. This court has agreed to consider five issues in Mr. Carmichael's case, and given that our time this afternoon is short, I'm going to begin by discussing the first issue involving ineffective assistance of counsel, and as time permits, move on to the remaining issues. I'd like to start by discussing what's not in dispute about Mr. Carmichael's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. It is not in dispute that the performance of Carl Fritz, the defense attorney, was deficient because he failed to inform Mr. Carmichael about the pertinent penalties he faced under the Sex Offender Lifetime Supervision Act, and actually simply failed to understand the applicable sentencing range in general. Everyone has been in agreement throughout the case that the first prong of the Strickland test has been met here. It is also not in dispute that in this context, in order to show prejudice requiring relief, the Strickland standard for ineffective assistance of counsel requires only that Mr. Carmichael show a reasonable probability that he would have accepted the plea bargain offered to him. The following factual matters are also not in dispute. Mr. Carmichael testified he would have taken the plea agreement had he been accurately advised rather than grossly misled about the penalties that he faced. Defense attorney Carl Fritz swore out an affidavit that it was his opinion that Mr. Carmichael rejected the plea offer based on his bad advice. It was undisputed that Mr. Carmichael encouraged Mr. Fritz, that was Mr. Fritz's words, to obtain a plea bargain. It was undisputed that Mr. Fritz repeatedly discussed with Mr. Carmichael his desire to get a good plea offer and discussed with him throughout the case working on a plea agreement prior to trial. It's also undisputed that Mr. Fritz told Mr. Carmichael the plea offer was, quote, not acceptable, and that Mr. Carmichael would not be doing any time, even if he rejected the bargain and was convicted of all the charges. It's undisputed that as late in the proceedings as the first day of trial, Mr. Fritz's co-counsel approached the prosecution, continuing to try to reach a plea agreement in this case.
Ms. Taylor, excuse me just a minute. Are all these facts that you're relating, are they based upon an affidavit that Mr. Fritz filed?
Many of them, let's see, the fact that he rejected the plea bargain based on his offer, that was in the affidavit. The repeated attempts, the discussions about the plea bargain, I believe that was also in the affidavit. Some of it, though, was also testified and repeated at the hearing on February 25th, 2002.
By whom? By Mr. Carmichael, you mean?
By Mr. Fritz.
Oh, by Mr. Fritz, okay.
Yeah, the witnesses at that hearing were Mr. Carmichael, Mr. Fritz himself testified, and Mr. Hammond, Mr. Fritz's trial co-counsel, also testified at that hearing. So when I say to you, Your Honor, that Mr. Carmichael encouraged him to take the plea, that was Mr. Fritz's testimony. That appears on page 50 of the February 25th transcript. When I say that he repeatedly discussed with him his desire to get a plea bargain offer, that testimony appears at pages 46 and 47 of that hearing transcript. And his testimony that he discussed a plea bargain throughout the case with him appears on page 41 of that February 25th hearing.
When you're using he and he, I'm confused as to who you're talking about. So Carmichael wanted Fritz to take a plea bargain or to get a plea bargain for him? Is that what you said?
Mr. Fritz, the defense attorney, I'll call him defense attorney.
Okay.
Although there's two defense attorneys, but primary defense attorney, Mr. Fritz. Defense attorney testified that Mr. Carmichael encouraged him to get a plea agreement. And the defense attorney testified.
So Carmichael wanted to enter to a plea?
Exactly.
Okay.
That was his testimony, undisputed at the hearing. Again, it was the defense lawyer's testimony, not Mr. Carmichael's, the defense lawyer's, that he told Mr. Carmichael the plea offer was not acceptable. That was the defense attorney's testimony. That appears on page 38 of that hearing. the testimony that is late as the first day of trial, that defense counsel number two approached the prosecution, that is also testimony from defense counsel number two, who testified at the February 25th hearing. So all these things that I'm talking about, except the very first thing, those don't come from Mr. Carmichael. Those are not his self-serving statements. So those are the sworn statements of his attorney, both in the affidavit that he swore out prior to the hearing and in his sworn testimony at the hearing itself, as well as the testimony of his co-counsel. And because all that is not in dispute, it's also not in dispute that the defense lawyer never told Mr. Carmichael that the charges he faced carried a sentence of life in prison, and that the best sentence he could hope for, if convicted, was 20 years to life on probation. So again, there's no dispute that in the best case scenario, a sentencing disparity between what he was offered and what he faced was a decade. At a minimum, it was a decade versus what he faced if he took the plea bargain versus what he faced if convicted at trial. So if you take these undisputed facts and look at them in light of the factors that courts have considered in deciding whether a defendant has presented objective evidence apart from his own assertion that he would have taken the plea bargain, there's really no question that there exists at least a reasonable probability, which is all the law requires Mr. Carmichael to show, that he would have accepted the plea bargain and that he's shown the requisite prejudice. Some of the factors that courts have considered are the advice, if any, that counsel has given regarding the plea offer. Here, it's undisputed, it was clearly wrong. The disparity between the terms offered and the real sentence possible, again here, it was a significant difference of at least a decade, and really the difference between probation and lifetime in prison. Whether the defendant indicated he was amenable to a plea bargain. Here, not only did the defendant testify to that effect, his attorney testified to that under oath. He swore out an affidavit to that effect, and he testified that he had repeated discussions with him up until the time of trial about the possibility of taking a plea bargain. All of these factors that other courts have considered in this context indicate that prejudice exists here.
Could I stop you just a moment? I should be following this better, I think, than from the briefs, but could you just say very plainly what the offer was, what those ranges were, and then what he was actually charged with and therefore was exposed to?
Well, the testimony indicated that at the hearing indicated that the offer was there was some conflicting testimony, actually, because the prosecution in questioning defense counsel repeated a version of the plea agreement that seemed even different than what the lawyer understood it to be. Because the prosecutor asked a question that indicated, and it's important to, there's a fact there that matters, that the prosecutor at the 35C hearing or the post-conviction hearing was not the prosecutor who engaged in these initial plea bargains. So two different prosecutors. She repeated a version of the plea offer that was to a class 5 felony attempted sexual assault on a child.
I'm sorry, which prosecutor? You're just not being clear.
The prosecutor at the 35C hearing described the offer made by the first prosecutor, who was not at the 35C hearing, as a class 5 attempted SAOC or plea to an SAOC class 4 with 10 years probation. She asked a question to that effect. And I'm assuming that she was referencing her file or something as a basis for that question. Defense attorney Fritz testified his understanding was class 4 felony, 10 years probation. Now, he didn't hear it as 10 to life. He didn't understand that there was such a thing as life. That was his testimony. And so there's some discrepancy there. It appears it was an offer of perhaps 10 to life probation. The actual minimum, though, the real penalties for conviction of a class 3 felony sexual assault on a child, the minimum probationary sentence under the statutes in effect at that time was 20 years, not 10, so double, a decade more. Also, the statutes made clear at that time that you have to serve that entire 20 years before you even get your first hearing to review whether you should continue on parole. So it is an actual decades difference. In terms of what he faced, really, apart from a discussion about probation, by my calculations, it was a class 3 felony. At that time, sexual assaults on a child by one in a position of trust were extraordinary risk crimes. So instead of 4 to 12, the range was increased to 4 to 16. It was also a statutory crime of violence, which would mean the range goes to 10 to 32. So we're talking a minimum prison sentence of 10 years up to life in prison. That's how I understand the actual penalties that he faced. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I was thrown off just a little bit about when we're going back and forth between probation and prison. You're saying if he went to trial, he faced a mandatory incarceration period?
Yes.
Okay.
And no one told him that. His lawyer told him. His lawyer just said he essentially apparently looked at 18-1105 that was in existence at that time, said class 3 felony, 4 to 12 years. That's his best recollection of what he said. In terms of the prison, he also told him, though, that there was no way he would go to prison. So
when you said he was wrong, that's what you mean, the part where he was wrong, when he said there's no way he'd go to prison, but he had to go to prison as a matter of law?
Well, that's one of the many things he was wrong about. If he was convicted at trial and the court decided to impose a prison sentence, there would have been a mandatory 10-year minimum. And I believe that defense counsel number 2 at the 35C hearing testified to that range. But he didn't join the case until late in the game and never had a discussion with the client about the actual penalties that he faced.
I was a little confused about whether the only problem was a failure to point out the effects of the sexual offender scheme, which would have a indeterminate range up to life. But that's not true. You're saying there actually was misinformation about the possibility of probation if he went to trial. And by contrast, he was given a firm offer of a recommendation to probation.
That's correct.
Which he turned down.
That's correct. And in fact, Your Honor, when the parties went to sentencing, after this hearing, the prosecutor argued for a prison sentence. It was always, not only was it always a possibility that he was never, that was never thoroughly explained to him, that's in fact what the DA argued for. Even after this issue arose where everyone knew he had been misled, the DA asked for a prison sentence. So it was always a very real possibility in this case.
Prison was required, though, right? I mean, I'm not sure.
No. If he was sentenced, there were minimum sentences no matter where he went. If the court chose to put him in prison, there would be a minimum prison sentence. If the court, and 10 years. If the court chose to put him on probation, there'd be a minimum probation period of 20 years.
Okay, that's what I thought you were saying to begin with. So in terms of minimums, we're talking about that he was offered a plea with a sentence recommendation of 10 years on probation.
Yes.
And if he went to trial, the minimum sentence he could have been given was 20 years on probation.
Right.
Okay.
Does anyone have any other questions about that? I hope that's clear. It is confusing, but that's the minimum disparity, that 10 years difference on probation, assuming he was going to get probation.
I have one question, and it's just something that's kind of capriciously, I think maybe in the Court of Appeals decision on page 8, if you happen to have it, but I'll just read it to you. It says, and they're saying why there wasn't prejudice, and it says, fourth, Carmichael admitted he was advised at an earlier hearing of the possible penalties for the charged offenses, including SOLSA. And what are they referring to there? It makes it seem as if he was at one point, perhaps by the judge, given the correct advisement.
Well, I think what they're referring to there is that the district attorney had suggested and offered that Mr. Carmichael had a first appearance that all criminal defendants have, where he would have been brought into court and advised of the charges against him and the penalties that carried. So I think that's what the court is referencing there. That wasn't something...
A judge's advisement as opposed to defense counsel?
Right, and at the very beginning of the case. And I don't believe that the district court relied on that. I don't recall that in its ruling, but you could review the record to double-check that. And, you know, there's also the obvious problem with that is that no one was there to explain to Mr. Carmichael what any of that meant, assuming that they were accurately stated, and assuming that that advisement went all into all the things I was discussing with Justice Coates about, you know, there are mandatory aggravators and mandatory minimums here. I don't know that those are usually discussed, but in a way that... you know, that didn't mean anything in light of the lengthy discussions over the course of time that Mr. Fritz had with Mr. Carmichael, telling him something, telling him exactly what was going to happen in his case, telling him exactly what the penalties were, and that being wrong. I don't think there was any suggestion that that somehow cured the problem or made the Sixth Amendment violation go away. It was something that the Court of Appeals threw in there. Essentially, what the Court of Appeals did was review this in a way that I would suggest to Your Honors is not the proper way to review this. The Court of Appeals said, well, something to the effect of, find it here. I think they called it record support. It said, we're going to go through the record and pluck out these things and say, well, there's record support for these findings, that his decision to reject the plea offer was motivated by his hope for an equivalent trial. So, Your Honor, even in respect to that finding by the Court of Appeals, they're only using that to say, well, we find there's some support here for this notion that he would have rejected the plea offer because he hoped to be acquitted at trial. But first of all, the record contradicts that finding. Mr. Carmichael's attorney, his defense attorney, swore out an affidavit that said his decision to reject the plea offer arose from his own horrifically misleading advice here. If your lawyer is basically telling you that a plea offer is unacceptable and you're going to get the same sentence even if you proceed to trial, why not proceed to trial? Your lawyer's telling you the risk is minimal. But in fact, the risk is huge here. It's significant, and that's why courts look at that as an objective measure, apart from any self-serving statement they think that the defendant may have made. That is, in fact, corroboration. The cases are clear on that. And I want to go back, because, again, the Court of Appeals decision and the trial court's decision arise from the same, I believe, misunderstanding of what the law here is, which is, well, he said he was innocent, he testified he was innocent, and so he would not have taken a plea offer. Well, first of all, the courts, the appellate courts that discuss that, they do consider that a factor, but they also recognize that, number one, and most importantly, it's not a dispositive factor. I think that it was the Illinois Supreme Court in the Curry case that said the fact that defendant chose to defend himself after rejecting the plea offer does little by itself to answer the question of why he refused the plea offer in the first place. In addition to the fact that it's clear in the law this is not a dispositive issue, courts also realize that defendants, when they're correctly advised about what they really face, might plead guilty even if they are innocent, or at least they might, even if they previously maintained their innocence. So that's why courts say, you know, we're going to look at other things to decide what's going on here, and we're not going to make that the issue, the only question in deciding whether or not someone has demonstrated prejudice. Because I'd like to keep going back to what the law requires. All the law requires is a showing of a reasonable probability.
May I ask you about that standard?
Sure.
I got a little lost in the authorities, and has the United States Supreme Court ever decided a case with regard to the failure to take a plea rather than seeking to revoke a plea? I mean, to undo a plea for ineffective assistance?
I cannot remember the exact context that some of these plea cases have arisen in.
And is the exact reasonable probability language you're talking about, does that come from this court?
The reasonable probability comes from Strickland itself, okay? And So, I mean, I don't think there's any dispute if you look through the case law about ineffective assistance of counsel. That's just, it's one of the standard ways.
But Strickland doesn't talk about the reasonable probability that he would have taken the plea.
No, that comes from the later cases, taking it and applying it in this exact context. So, there's not a case that's directly on this situation from the U.S. Supreme Court. There are many cases from other state courts and from the federal courts that have taken it and applied it in this context, and they all, I think, uniformly talk about it in this manner.
But I take it then from that last statement you made, but you don't know of any case this court has ever decided in which it has set out a standard for ineffective assistance for failing to take a plea?
In this court? This court?
This court.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I would hope that either one of us would have cited it, and I don't think we did. So, yeah, the fact that the issue is new to this court, take comfort in the fact that it's not new to courts around the country, though. And that's why I say the law is not, this isn't a case where you really have to grapple with what the law is. Many other courts have looked at it. There are some areas where they differ in some of the particulars. I think I mentioned one in my brief where some of the courts say, we're not so clear that you have to show this objective evidence. As I say in my footnote, that's not really a legal issue that this court needs to grapple with, because when you look at the cases that describe what objective evidence is, it exists in this case. So the broad areas, the broad parameters of the law have been, discussed in many cases cited in our briefs. I'll just say again that applying the factors that the courts have looked at to make sure that the evidence of the defendant's ineffective claim exists apart from his own statements, Mr. Carmichael clearly corroborated his claim of prejudice, and the district court was wrong to rule that no corroboration existed. So Mr. Carmichael is asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision, affirming the district court's decision on that issue. If the court doesn't have additional questions about that, I'd like to just really quickly talk about the challenge for cause issue.
Go ahead.
Okay. And given that, I'd like to start out this issue by trying to clarify some facts for the court as well, and hopefully I can accomplish that. I want to start out by talking about an issue that was that played a prominent role in the Court of Appeals decision. That is the Court of Appeals conclusion that the sole basis for the challenge for cause was the answer Juror H gave in the jury questionnaire. The actual challenge for cause in this case and the defense and prosecution arguments about it occurred in one of those things that we in the appellate world can't stand, which is an unrecorded bench conference. And as a result of that, we don't have the actual arguments made by counsel, only what the court said after the fact. And what the court said, and this is in the transcript of the October 10th, 2001 proceedings, starting at the bottom of page 46, was, I do have a record to make with regard to juror number 9, PH. That's the juror at issue here. At the bench conference at the completion of the voir dire questioning by the defense, a challenge for cause was made as to Ms. H., based on the questioning and the answers given in her jury questionnaire. And then the court repeated the answer from the questionnaire. Later in the court's ruling, it said that she, meaning Juror H, has very strong feelings about the charges in these kinds of crime. So the Attorney General and the Court of Appeals have said that the record indicates that the challenge was based solely on the questionnaire. And the Attorney General has argued there's no indication that the transcript is missing any questions from the defense. But I would respectfully suggest that.
So these would have been questions to Juror H.
Right.
So there was. So it's your position that there was some questioning of H, and that was on the record, right?
Yes. Well,
but not transcribed or not adequately transcribed would be your position.
Not transcribed at all.
And how was that? And then there was conversation among the attorneys and the judge. That was off the record?
That's correct.
Intentionally off the record?
All challenges for cause were off the record. They were made at off-the-record bench conferences. So yes, exactly, Your Honor. It appears that there, based on what the court said after the fact, that there was questioning of Juror H by the defense as well.
Which we really have none of, right? We just don't, that's not
No, when Ms. Keegan spent her 25-hour painstaking review of voir dire, she found no questions to Juror H, not a single one, not of any substance, not by the court, not by the defense attorneys, and not by the prosecution. They just do not exist. The portion that was off the record, or it appears was off the record, was the actual challenge itself where the arguments were made. And then what we have after all of that is the court's ruling itself. So the after-the-fact description by the trial court indicates there was questions from both parties of Juror H. And that's what the record establishes. The other thing I want to clarify about the record is the Court of Appeals' conclusion that the trial court was in the best position to evaluate Juror H's demeanor, and that that also supported the ruling. Nothing in the court's ruling, or at least the version of the ruling that we have, references Juror H's demeanor. So that should not be a basis for upholding the ruling on appeal when it was not a basis for the ruling of the court below. So given that there's questioning by the parties missing, there's no finding of demeanor for this court to refer to. Really, what this court is left with in terms of review is the actual finding itself. So the Attorney General has taken this position that the missing portion can only refute the defendant's position that the juror was biased against him. But the point is, we have no idea what that record says. And this court, again, this is an area where the law about this is not really difficult to understand. This court's jurisprudence is clear that to review a challenge for cause, an appellate court has to look at the entire discussion the parties have with the juror at issue. It's not a question to consider whether, you don't consider just was there a ruling and was it sufficiently stated. In other words, you don't just review the ruling, you must look at what the jurors actually said.
Ms. Taylor, I'm sorry, I'm just so hung up on what the record actually shows, because the Court of Appeals seems to suggest that the judge is saying that there was only voir dire of this juror by the prosecution.
I understand that the Court of Appeals said that, and I understand, I mean, I can sort of see why they're saying that, because that is the focus of the court's ruling. But it is not. Interestingly, they also quote that portion that I just read to you.
Right.
It's on page 14 of their opinion, right there at the beginning. So they just seem, I mean, that, you know, it does say that. But that isn't what the record says. So I guess I would suggest that's just clearly erroneous based on, I mean, what little we have to go on here. And admittedly, it's almost nothing. But that's certainly, the ruling itself suggests there was questioning.
Do we have the transcript of the prosecution's questions of the juror?
No.
So we don't have any transcript of H at all?
No.
Not even nothing? Not even like the beginning stuff when the judge...
Ms. Keegan, I believe this is in Ms. Keegan's September 25th, 2005 status report where she goes through. Mm-hmm. She found a place where the prosecutor asked a question of another juror and said, oh, if juror H did X, that's there. But apart from that, in terms of any questions of substance, no, there's nothing.
Okay,
thank you. And the fact that there's nothing is not Mr. Carmichael's fault. It's the fault of the incompetent, unqualified court reporter whose notes were riddled with gaps, who was dropping a lot of words that were spoken and simply not recording them at all, who took the time in several instances in this voir dire itself to make the transcripts look like nothing was missing, when in fact substantial portions of it were missing. And when that happens, and especially when it's in the instance of something as important to a case as a challenge for cause, the appellate courts should reverse the conviction. And I see I have only a minute left, and I'd like to leave at least that much time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, defense counsel. My name is Kathy Gillespie, and I'm representing the people this afternoon. My registration number is 26109. I am going to start, as Ms. Taylor did, with the ineffective assistance of counsel involving the plea bargain, and I'd like to make a couple of corrections. my interpretation to the questions that you asked, Justice Coates. Because a lot, I would agree that a lot of these cases talk about one factor that this court should consider as to whether or not this defendant would have taken a plea bargain is the disparate sentence. And unfortunately, in this case, it's not really comparing apples to apples because we do have a advisement under the determinant sentencing laws. And in this case, taking out the misdemeanors, the defendant was facing one Class 3 felony and three Class 4 felonies. And so...
I'm sorry, Ms. Tusby.
Yes, sir.
You just, this isn't, you just said advisement of under regular Class 3 felony procedure. What were you referring to? The first advisement?
Correct. The defendant was advised by his attorney, his trial counsel, testified at the motion for new trial hearing that he had advised him under 18.115.
Oh, I see. I didn't understand.
So what I'm trying to do is compare for the court the two, what the advisement was given, which would have been, in my estimation and my understanding is that on a Class 3 sex assault in a child position of trust, that is not a crime of violence. That is a F3 extraordinary risk crime. If it's a pattern, it's a crime of violence. And if there's charge of any injury, anything like that, it's a crime of violence. But in this case, it was not. So my calculation is that this defendant would have been looking at 4 to 32 years if aggravation was found. He was probation eligible, which is evidenced by the fact that he did receive probation in this case. And then obviously on the Class 4 felonies, it was 2 to 8 or 2 to 16 if the court had found aggravation. And that, what the court would then have to do to look at this, whether or not these ramifications were disparate, was to look at, for a Class 3 felony, it's 4 to life, and on a Class 4 felony, it's 2 to life. I would agree with defense counsel's that it's 20 to life on probation for a Class 3, 10 to life on a Class 4. So what this defendant was offered was a Class 4 felony. There was some disagreement as to whether or not the prosecutor had actually said 10 to life or just 10, but he was offered the lowest charge with a probationary stip, and then went to trial.
But it was still a charge that would have qualified for the lifetime sex offender sentencing. Is that right?
That's correct.
So the plea he was offered was to a crime that would require an indeterminate sentence with life as its upper end, and so was the crime that he was actually convicted of by going to trial.
Correct.
Okay.
He was obviously convicted of a higher class felony than the offer, but yes, that would be right.
But both of them involved a maximum sentence. Both of them involved indeterminate sentences with a maximum at the upper end of life sentence.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's correct. And then back to you, Justice Rice. There was an advisement of the defendant at his initial appearance. He was advised under SULSA and was told all of the indeterminate.
Now you're talking about the judge.
Correct. The judge advised him. And then at the motion for new trial hearing, the defendant testified that he remembered receiving that advisement from the trial court. So I am not going to stand up here and tell you that this case is pretty. I am not going to stand up here and tell you that this case is easy. I think it is a very close call. I think what the trial courts need from you all is a case that gives some parameters so that when these situations arise, the trial courts have some background as to what to look at. What factors should they be looking at? A lot of the cases that are cited by the defense that come from federal circuits and other states talk about, everybody's pretty much in agreement that the defendant's self-serving statements aren't going to be enough by themselves, for obvious reasons. And then some of the jurisdictions talk about, well, the objective evidence that's going to show you this reasonable probability is going to be, let's use disparate treatment. I think that the Court of Appeals, in their discussion of the various factors, was smart to broaden that a little bit. Because if all you look at is a defendant's self-serving statements and the disparate sentencing options that he faced, your role is now becoming one of protecting the defendant from his dumb decisions. We all know that.
Well, as misleading counsel made decision for him because he didn't really think he had any choice, really. I mean, nothing to lose here, right? you're going to be exonerated, you're not going to get any time, whatever counsel told him, you know, that record speaks for itself. But I don't understand what you're asking us to do, because it seems to me, evaluate the testimony about the plea that was offered versus what he got. Well, what else can we do?
Well, I think you can look at the other objective evidence that came out in the hearing itself. The attorney testified, and it's my recollection, and I will admit that it's been a while since I've read this record, but it's my recollection that it was the attorney that was trying to get the defendant to plead and trying to encourage the plea negotiations, and that was not originating with the defendant. So I would ask this court to look at that itself.
So there's a contradictory testimony?
I think there is.
And
the other thing the attorney testified to was that he told the defendant that the chances of him going to prison were slim because he had a clean criminal history, and that in fact happened. He did get a probationary sentence. And I understand it's longer than what he anticipated, but it was a probationary sentence. He was advised on a pretty significant, if the judge had for some reason decided to stack those charges, the defendant was looking at 60 plus years in prison if the court had tried to go that way at the sentencing hearing. So despite knowing that he's facing a significant prison sentence, he still turns down a probationary offer. And one thing that I thought was critical from looking at the testimony of both the, mainly from the attorney itself, was that when the prosecutor asked him what his recommendation was and what the discussions were with the defendant about probation, the attorney testified that they had some real concerns about probation because the defendant was not willing to admit to the allegations. So there was obviously going to be, once he got onto sex offender probation, there was going to be an issue as to whether or not he could complete that treatment successfully. And there was discussion of that in the hearing as well. Then the defendant testified that he remembered the trial court's advisement. He testified at trial that he was innocent, and he admitted at the hearing for the motion for new trial that he had maintained his innocence all the way through this process. The trial court's ruling stated that based on what he had seen and gotten to know of this defendant over the course of however long he was in front of this trial court, that the defendant, and this is a quote, completely, repeatedly, and vigorously maintained his innocence. So this idea that there is all this objective evidence out there, you have to take it in context with all the other evidence. So the attorneys...
So as I understand what you're saying is that your recollection of the record is that the defendant did not tell... I'm now talking about the lawyer's testimony, your affidavit. Defendant did not ask his attorney to get a plea bargain for him?
That's my recollection, and it doesn't appear anywhere in my notes. So I again will defer to
would you agree,
obviously what's there.
Would you agree if, I mean, that's pretty, I guess we can just check that. but if the attorney did testify to that, let's just make that assumption for a second. Wouldn't you consider that a significant factor?
I would consider it another factor.
Another factor?
Another factor, because I think, you know, what is the defendant asking for? I mean, yes.
Well, the defendant wants to get off as best he can. Right?
Exactly. So is he asking for the defense attorney to go get a reasonable plea offer? Is he saying that he wants to get out of this? I think you have to take all these factors and balance them.
Well, there's a whole, people plead guilty every day when they tell their lawyers they're innocent because they want to get the benefit of the plea bargain.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
I could tell you that many of us could give a penny for lots of clients that told us that they're innocent, but I'd like you to get me a plea bargain.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's quite significant if it's true that the lawyers testified that to me would be a very important, if not significant, dispositive factual circumstance as to whether or not there's a reasonable probability that the plea would, that the conviction would be different.
And I think you have to look at that in light of this whole thing about him being willing to admit and whether or not he's going to be successful on probation, because obviously that's going to factor into that decision too, that just getting a sex offender an offer of probation isn't the end of the line. And
well,
clearly this attorney was factoring that into whether or not he should go to trial.
Did the attorney, because that certainly, we have a case that raises that this afternoon. at issue. So did the attorney talk in his testimony about whether if he were on probation, he'd have to make an admission of guilt?
Yes, and he also testified that that was going to be a problem. And so I think what we need from this court is, Justice Coates, back to you. I was not able to find any case in Colorado, with the exception of the ones in these, what we now call the Arapaho 8 cases, all of these cases involving Ms. Barnes. I haven't been able to find any discussion that lays out very clearly, with the exception of the Court of Appeals in this case, giving you a variety of different factors, because the trial court shouldn't be looking at just the factors of the defense statements and the disparate treatment, because that doesn't take into account those defendants who have rolled the dice, lost, and now are clamoring to get back to that offer that now looks great. And our job is not to protect them from their bad decisions. Our job is to protect them, obviously, from bad legal advice, and to protect them from any sort of bad faith negotiating that's going on. So I think there needs to be a list of factors that is greater than just those two.
Well, where do you suggest we find those factors?
Well, the Court of Appeals lays out some, talking about the probable consequences of proceeding to trial. I think one of the factors, and they list a variety of circuit decisions. But I think one thing that's important to look at is the strength of the evidence against the defendant. If there's a confession and, you know, at the time of the plea, the case looked fairly strong against the defendant, I think that's a factor that should be looked at. If the evidence is not very strong, in this particular case, as far as our sex assault cases go, the facts in this case were not particularly egregious as far as, you know, confessions, and he had a wife that was backing him up as to whether or not he had gone down into the basement where these acts took place. So, and, you know, what the defendant was, yes, what the advisement is, but also what the defendant is facing in reality. I mean, probably the only thing this trial attorney got right was the fact that with his clean criminal history and the facts of this case, chances are, if you went to trial and were convicted, you were going to get probation, and he did. So I think what this court needs to do is lay out some of those factors for the trial court so that when these situations arise, there are factors for not only the DA and the defense attorney to look at to get evidence in front of this court that will help it make this reasonable probability decision, because you are looking at it in hindsight. And obviously everybody's decision after they've gone to trial, been convicted, and are facing a significant sentence, that decision is going to look very different when it comes back to you. So I think what I would like to see come out of this opinion in this case is have this court give us that kind of test that would lay out for all the attorneys down there doing the dirty work what they need to be looking for and what factors need to be considered so that we get that evidence up and on the record for this court's review when it's time. Then moving to the challenge for cause. The test, I think what this court has a very limited role on this particular issue. This court needs to take the test and the standard that it's laid out over and over again about whether or not the record supports the trial court's decision to deny the challenge for cause. We have the roadblock thrown in here that we have Ms. Barnes, who completed the transcript in this case, and she actually did all of the transcripts in this case with the exception of 2 days of trial and one ruling on that motion for new trial. And looking at the record that we do have in front of us, I would agree with defense counsel that there is no indication from the record that sits before you any conversation between the prosecutor and Juror H. There's no indication as to whether or not that conversation may or may not have taken place in chambers and wasn't recorded the way the bench conferences weren't recorded. We really have no idea. So what we're forced to do is look at the record that we do have in front of us. And what we do have is the court's offer of proof after it had denied the challenge for cause. And that denial based on the colloquy. So we have this juror out there who says, I have concerns about people, these crimes and the people who commit them. It was nothing directed at the defendant specifically. Then the court went through its questioning of the jury panel after some explanation, the typical reading of the various instructions, reasonable doubt, presumption of innocence, things like that. Then we have the court asking the jury panel as a whole, if anyone feels a bias for or against the defendant based on the charges, and there's no response from any of the jurors on the panel. We then have a question from the court, is there anyone here who has would have a problem giving the presumption of innocence to the defendant? Again, nothing. Then we do have two questions from the defense attorney during his jury questioning of the panel as a whole. If there anyone has any concerns about their ability to be fair and impartial, and juror H does not raise her hand. It says in the record that no jurors respond. And that's true again when the defendant asks if anyone would have a problem now that, you know, the questions that they do where there is, you know, there's been no evidence presented. Does everybody understand that that means that he's not guilty if you were asked to decide now? There are no questions in the record that we have of the from the defense attorney to juror H itself. So that is the evidence that you have in front of it. There, when the offer of proof was made by the trial court, the defendant did not offer any supplementation of that, didn't correct the court at all about it being based on the questionnaire. And I think based on that, I think that this court can affirm the trial court's denial of that challenge for cause. That's if you take out completely the trial court's ruling or the trial court's statements based on the colloquy that we obviously can't review. Did that make sense, Justice Bender?
You confused me about the offer of proof. I just didn't understand. When was that?
After.
What's the sequence?
It sounds like what happened is all the questioning took place.
Yeah, I got it.
The parties went up. They made their challenges for cause at the bench. They stepped back, and that's when the judge made a record, and maybe record is a better word than offer of proof. The judge made a record about why he denied the challenge for causes to juror H.
And part of that record that he made characterized the answers of juror H. Was that right?
That's correct.
And what you're saying is nobody challenged his characterization?
Nobody challenged it. And we did have the questionnaire is in the record, so the court can read her questionnaire itself. I do want to just point out very quickly a couple of issues on the delay of the appeal. And I think with the accuracy of the transcripts and the delay in the appellate process here and whether or not that arose to a due process violation, I would encourage the court that in the majority of the opening brief, there is a lot of factual information that is not relevant to this case. There's a lot of testimony about court reporters talking about work Ms. Barnes had done in other cases. And I would encourage the court, I went back and looked at this court reporter certificate at the back of all of the volumes of this particular trial. And Ms. Barnes did all of the transcripts with the exception, again, I said of the motion for new trial and 2 days of trial was actually done by a Ms. Bachler. And I think the federal cases and then Rios, which this court had denied cert on back in 2001, I think lay out the appropriate test. And one thing, I think we can get through the first three fairly quickly, and then we get to the prejudice, and that seems to be where the majority of the sticking point is. And here, I think the court needs to look at what the prejudice is to this particular defendant. The court reporter that sat at the trial is the one that transcribed all of his transcripts. And in this particular case, from the notice of appeal to everything in the trial being completed, with the exception of the court's ruling on the motion for new trial, was 19 months. It was then put on an expedited appellate schedule, I believe, by the Court of Appeals. And went through that process. There were no extensions offered to either side down in the Court of Appeals. So I think in this case, looking at the prejudice factors that are outlined in a lot of the federal cases, again, it's important to point out that the defendant has not been incarcerated. He's been out on probation. They talk about minimizing the anxiety and the concerns about the results. There's nothing about this process that stands out other than the fact that he's on sex offender probation and is having to go about what those different requirements are.
What, excuse me, what length of probation did he end up with? 20 years?
20 years to life.
Could you, I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but somewhere in your discussion,
sure.
Talk about the other case we denied cert on, I think it's Whitaker, which also involved same court reporters' problems with transcripts.
And discuss what about the...
What's different, whether it's the same or what it might be different with this case and that?
The things that are different, and I tend to get some of them confused, but the length of time that those cases were up and the portions of the record that were have to put kind of piecemeal together, not using Ms. Barnes, there were portions of their trial as the hearing started down in front of Justice Volokh down in the trial court. He was appointed by Arapahoe County to handle all this appellate issue with the records. There were much larger portions of those transcripts missing, and a lot more court reporters having to get involved with trying to decipher Ms. Barnes' notes and trying to figure out what she had done. All of Mr. Carmichael's were completed before Ms. Barnes finally retained counsel and absolutely refused to participate any further. I think the only thing we were missing at that point was the ruling on the motion for new trial. But we did have the testimony, and I believe the argument. If not, we had at least the testimony of the motion for new trial. And I think that's what I pointed out in my answer brief for you all, was that, you know, there was no effort to comply with the Appellate Rule 10 to recreate this record until 2.5 years after this process started. Even when the trial court, even when Justice Volokh was asking the public defender's office to help recreate the record, don't rely on Ms. Barnes, let's get this done, they were still indicating, we have her notes, we want to use her notes, we want to do this, we want to do that. And obviously, 2.5, 3 years after the fact, there wasn't a lot of recollection. The prosecutor was able, from her notes, was able to recreate and do an affidavit as to what her arguments were for the motion for new trial. But the trial judge at the time and the attorney for the defendant were unable to come up with anything that was helpful at that time. So I think that the court, one, has to look and make sure that the facts that you're reviewing are relevant to Mr. Carmichael's case, and two, needs to take into consideration what the true reason for the majority of these delays were, and that there was some chess playing going on and everybody not wanting to cooperate in recreating the record and wanting to go with this particular path, which was getting Ms. Barnes and getting her notes to somebody to take care of her notes and have her review them, rather than recreating, or in this case, asking for a de novo review of the testimony. We had the testimony for the motion for new trial. They could have asked the Court of Appeals, since we don't have the court's ruling, review it de novo. Here's the testimony. So I think there were a lot of other options that could have shortened that time period had everybody's goal been to get this case up on appeal as quickly as possible.
Well, with respect to Juror H, now I think you said there's nothing in the transcript of examination, particularly of Juror H. Is that right?
That's correct.
Do we know whether the juror was examined or not?
No. We do know from the court's ruling that there were questions from the prosecutor to Juror H and some sort of, you know, questioning about what her questionnaire meant as far as her ability to be fair and impartial, just based from his reference in his ruling. We don't know whether or not, I mean, if these attorneys had the bench conferences off the record, we don't know if there was questioning done in chambers that was off the record as well. And so we don't really know. And since Ms. Barnes obviously isn't cooperating, we really don't know whether or not that was ever in her notes or where it is.
Okay.
All we have is what is in front of the court. And it's the people's position that what is in front of the court is sufficient for this court to make a finding. And if the court doesn't have any questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
please the court. I want to start back on issue one, this notion that the Attorney General says, well, the defendant didn't ask his lawyer to get a plea agreement for him. And I think the record simply contradicts that. It's on page 50 of the hearing that was held on February 25th, 2002. The defense attorney, Carl Fritz, testifies that the defendant, and this is his words, encouraged him to get a plea bargain. I think the Attorney General is just wrong on that point. Their approach to this case, I guess, in asking this court to even expand the factors beyond what other courts have done, is to sort of treat this as if the defendant has to prove this to a certainty. And the law is clear. He does not have to prove it to a certainty that he would have taken the plea agreement. All he has to prove is that there's a reasonable probability. And courts have laid out some of those factors, and almost every single factor that courts around the country look at indicate that in this case, Mr. Carmichael has demonstrated a reasonable probability that he would have taken the plea bargain. The court was wrong to rule otherwise, and he is entitled to relief. I would just ask this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you, Your Honors.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsels for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.